First of all, I want to thank Saber for inviting me. I want to thank all of you for coming. And the fellow in the blue shirt, all the way in the back of the room, can you hear me when I'm away from the microphone, just in case I start wandering? You guys can hear me? Okay, because I wander. Okay. Can the members of the Black Sox scandal committee that are here raise their hand? Nice and high. Okay. So you're my fact checkers, and especially Bruce Allardyce. In the year of 8 myths out, I certainly don't want to add to any of them with anything I present today. So I am not defensive, and I'm open to any fact-checking, okay? Now, I'm going to probably read more than I care to. That's because I have some quotes that I want to use. So I apologize for that. I will try to freelance it as much as I am capable in the next 18 minutes or so. I am going to share the backstory in this session, the afterlife, as I call it, that helped shape the life and career of sports writer Hugh Fullerton III. Okay, there's a page on Hugh from a local newspaper in Ohio. In doing this, what I hope to do is add some context to the fix of a World Series that took place 100 years ago this year. This is the centennial of the 1919 World Series, as many, if not all of you, are aware. I'd like to make sure that we separate the fix, which took place in 1919, from the scandal, which took place afterwards, as most scandals do. A powerful, if not unquestionably favored, Chicago White Sox team featuring two healthy future Hall of Fame members, Eddie Collins and Ray Schalk, not to mention the club owner, Charles Comiskey, and about to be discredited Black Sox players, Eddie Seacott and a guy named Joe, and that's not Biden, Joe Jackson, Shoeless Joe Jackson. It was a powerful team. They had some great players. The White Sox played the Cincinnati Reds, a team strong on the mound, but underestimated by many in 1919, including Hugh Stewart Fullerton III, and still underestimated by some people today. Okay so far, Bruce? Okay. Fullerton was the third Hugh Stewart Fullerton in a line that will sadly eventually end with now 80-year-old Hugh Stewart Fullerton V. He is a retired college professor. He's 80 years old and never married. So anybody know Hugh the V? So I'll refer to all these Hughes. Hi, Jacob. I wore my big boy pants for you today after shorts the whole time. There are five of them, so I don't want to confuse all these Fullertons. I'm going to talk about three of them, the grandfather, father, and Hugh the Third, who I will refer to as Huey, which is what his friends called him because I guess they liked to drink with him. Hugh the Third was the most famous dopester in the land for a quarter century, or at least until the early 1920s. He came to Chicago in 1896 to the Chicago Record. I'll talk a little bit more about that and the changing names of newspapers and why we get confused on sometimes who worked where when. What is a dopester? Who knows what a dopester is? I don't have to answer all these questions. What's a dopester? I know Bruce knows. Who else knows? Okay, Steve, I know you know. I know Jacob knows. These are Black Sox committee people. So how many people know what a dopester is who is not a Black Sox member? Okay, that tells me something. A dopester is someone we might call a Saber metrics person today. I want to make that connection simply because this is Saber. Huey had no computer, of course, just a pencil and a very, very precise mind. And see, I'm very, very bad at keeping up with my slides, so let me catch up. There's the 1919 Chicago White Sox. There's the Black Sox, who are among those 1919 White Sox, and now I'm caught up. In his time, Huey was a combination Peter Gammons, Bill James, and a little Billy Bean thrown in too. That's pretty good when you think about it. You would think that you Black Sox scandal committee members would know about him the way you perhaps know about Ring Lardner. How many people know Ring Lardner? How many people know Grantland Rice? Until a couple moments ago, how many of you knew about Hugh Fullerton? Okay, good. Okay, then actually what I'm doing here is totally unnecessary in trying to retrieve his legacy. His body of work, again, I'm going to be talking to you about his afterlife. His body of work demonstrates that he's also part Martha Stewart, Dale Carnegie, and Susie Orman. Did I pronounce that right, Bruce? Orman? I don't know. She's not a baseball person. What's that? Okay, Orman. Okay. He was very eclectic in his writing. He wrote a lot of success literature. He wrote a series of 3 children's books. He wrote for the Chicago Worker section of the Chicago Tribune from about 04 to 1907. No one, and I checked this, no one got more letters to the editor than Huey, and especially from women, as he provided advice to the lovelorn, how to run a household, the proper place of a man and a woman in the household, and boy, did the women write in. Okay, he was very much a man of his time, so he may not have been a hashtag Me Too person, but he was very much a hashtag man of his times. Huey's father, and I don't have a picture of him, that's his grandfather. Huey's father, Hugh Stuart Fullerton II, was a Civil War officer who began the conflict with a rogue Ohio outfit called the Squirrel Hunters. Anybody hear of the Squirrel Hunters? They were an Ohio rogue group that went into Kentucky to deal with slaveholders there at the start of the Civil War. They were called Squirrel Hunters because they only carried their squirrel guns into Kentucky. Later in the war, Hugh II was an officer in the famous Union Heavy Artillery Unit. This unit was supposed to go across Georgia with Sherman, but did not, because it would have slowed him down. You know, Patton-like, he did not want to wait for it. When he came back home, he was a physician, later a pharmacist in Hillsboro, Ohio. He would sometimes speak in a Scotch-Irish dialect that no one else understood, just to tease his family members and friends. This is Hugh I. Huey's grandfather, Hugh Stuart Fullerton I, was a Presbyterian minister. His flock called him the Salem Saint back in South Salem, Ohio, which is now called Salem, and was once called Buckskin. Is that correct, Rick Hune? I think I saw Rick Hune somewhere. Yeah, you're good on your Ohio geography, being from the, in that general area. There we go. That's William Holmes McGuffey. Now, what does William Holmes McGuffey have to do with the Black Sox scandal? That's really what I'm going to get to here today. The first, HSF 1, studied from 1839 to 1843 at Ohio University, where he came under the educational influence of William Holmes McGuffey, of soon-to-be McGuffey Readers fame. How many of you heard of the McGuffey Readers? Very good. Okay, we're not bringing them back, so don't worry about that. Hugh I was a fervent educator and abolitionist. He built, and this is a quote from a family biography, a 126-page family biography that I obtained from the family of the Fullerton family, 12 generations, 6 of them in this country, dating back to 1619, the third trip to Jamestown by John Smith. So, quote,
he built for himself a large house at the forks of the road in South Salem, which still stands and which became famous as one of the big stations of the Underground Railroad. Hugh I founded Salem Academy, which after 1843 became, and I'll quote, the cradle of abolition and the home nest of missionaries, lawyers, teachers, ministers, and doctors, statesmen, and civic leaders, a dangerous group. He had ideas about education, in essence, McGuffey ideas, and practiced them at home with his own children, including Hugh II. Who had by then laid down his squirrel gun. I learned about the family's background and genealogy in that unpublished 126-page history called An American Testament. Okay. Sorry. The last half dozen of those generations, as I said, dates back to 1619 in this country. Huey completed... Just Hugh I. Okay, there's the cover of his typewritten the typewritten document. Huey had a typewriter. I don't know if he didn't change the ribbon often, and certain letters jumped. How many of you go back to typewriter days where letters jumped? Okay, you know. How many have no idea what I'm talking about? Okay. Okay, let me catch up with myself here. Other than, Hugh completed the typewritten document between his retirement from the Columbus Dispatch, which he worked at from 1928 to 1935. He went home to Ohio from New York and Chicago. He completed it between 35 and his death on December 27th, 1945. Other than the then-living Fullerton family members noted on the cover who shared an American Testament with me, you're just the second audience I've shared this history with, the first just a month ago at the Cooperstown Symposium. So what does all this family business have to do with a fixed World Series and the resulting cover-up and scandal? More important, as I asked earlier, why should it even matter? Ever since Elliot Azanoff published Eight Men Out 56 years ago in 1963, a book that lately has been shrouded by its own beguiling narrative and mythology, I've learned much about Huey and the remarkable family that precedes him. What follows now and what I'll expand on just a little later this afternoon at 5:30 when I speak to the Sabre Baseball and Media Research Committee about Huey and the ethical impulse in sports writing takes place after the surprising Reds defeated the favored White Sox 5-3. It was a best of nine series. As how many were, Jake, up to total? Three? 1903, 1919, and what's that? 1921. Okay, 1921? Okay. See, I have all these fact checkers here. What happened before Huey's so-called afterlife, he was born on September 10th, 1873 in Hillsboro, and he was 46 years old in 1919, informs the final 26 years of his life. But his final quarter century defines the man who was first to reveal the 1919 World Series and the fact that it was crooked. In doing so, however, Fullerton found his reputation as a baseball writer temporarily in tatters. Just as he did before 1919, Huey wrote prolifically for newspapers and magazines after 1919, both as a staff writer, and this distinction is important, I think, for those of you that do research on people that work for newspapers with names that have since changed. He worked as a staff writer and as a syndicated writer. That syndication has sometimes confused his biographers as to where he was when and whether he worked in one place or another. I think I sent that to you, Jacob. He wrote three more books, two on boxing, one on horse racing, after 19 for a total of 8 books. And just as he did from his earliest years in Chicago, beginning in 1896, Huey was as eclectic in his subject matter as he was prolific. As he grew older, Huey became less known as a baseball beat writer and more as a feature writer. And this really started before 1919. He really wasn't a beat writer much after the early 1900s. Here are some highlights from those post-1919 years for you to consider as I try to build a case that, 5 minutes left or 5 minutes gone?
Left.
Ooh, I'm so bad at this. While he was sporting editor of the New York Evening Mail, which he moved to from the New York Evening World in December 1920, Huey wrote The Ten Commandments of Sport and Everything Else in American in the August 1921 issue of American Magazine, a favorite publishing platform of his back to 1910. How many of you are familiar with... I get full behind on my slides. There we go. The Code of a Good Sport. Anybody familiar with this? Huey's commandments, he believed, could apply to business, home, friendship, and life. People who honor the game they play, no matter what that game may be, are sportsmen and bring honor to themselves. This is pure McGuffey, which brings me to the McGuffey readers and their connection to Fullerton, who practiced and fervently believed that there was an ethical impulse in sports writing and everything else. In 1927, November 26th, he wrote an article in Saturday Evening Post called That Guy McGuffey that ties his legacy, Huey's legacy, to the ethical impulse in sports writing, to his family, his upbringing, and William Holmes McGuffey himself. So who was that guy McGuffey to Huey? To quote Huey from that family testament, he evolved a new system of education, something Hugh the First also did, as I said, was the finest moral and cultural force in the United States during the formative period of the West and gave millions of young Americans their taste for good reading. He drove home more moral lessons in the form of stories than many of the preachers, like his dad, grandfather, than they did from the pulpits. I mean, the point I want to make here is that Huey really bought into these McGuffey readers. In his later life, in his afterlife, he tried to bring them back into American classrooms. He, I think, was pretty conservative throughout his career. He covered the 1912 Democratic and Republican conventions, covered them like they were baseball games. Very, very interesting to read. Later in life had a correspondence which I found in the McGuffey Museum in the basement in a box that was pretty much buried, hadn't really been, the material hadn't been filed, with Harvey Minich, who was the head of the McGuffey Societies. These letters demonstrate, again, that conservatism. He was afraid of America being Sovietized, as he said in his own words, and he wanted to return the books to the classroom so that children would be raised with the same moral lessons and fortitude that he felt he had. I want to say something, too. I met Jim Leakey, who wrote a book on Major League ball players who served during World War I. Jim raised the point in Cooperstown. Jim is a Navy man. He raised the point that Huey had used the word in relation to a player that was not named, the word yellowness, kind of like PTSD. Did I get those letters right? They didn't have a word for it then. They called it yellowness. It offended Jim, and I heard him. So I want to make the point, despite his firm McGuffey ethical backbone, Huey was not an angel. He smoked, he drank, he didn't gamble, was very, very much against gambling, and he just wasn't perfect. So that's for Jim Leakey, who kind of introduced me to something I needed to add. In reading that that guy McGuffey, the article in Saturday Evening Post, Huey quotes from an article that Timothy Flint wrote. You know, Hugh wrote two series of three article investigations of gambling in both America and in baseball, one in 1915 in American, one in 1927 in Liberty, where he wrote 141 articles between 1924 and 1937, the majority of them before 1928 when he left for Columbus. I think this really informs why he was so anti-gambling. The essay read, the love of gambling steals, perhaps more often than any other sin, with an imperceptible influence on the victim. My dear reader, let me implore you, this is Flint, not Fullerton, by the mercies of God and the worth of your soul, to contemplate this enormous evil only from a distance. Another appalling view of gambling is that it is the prolific stem, the fruitful parent of all other vices. In the article, Fullerton talks about how that influenced him, how he never forgot that lesson. And I think that informs why he wrote the way he did, why he, among other journalists better known now than he, why he was the one that had the guts to reveal that the World Series was thrown. Other people wrote about it, but Huey was the only one that stuck with it, moved from Chicago to New York, did a series of articles from December 15th through the 22nd that dealt with the subject, and then turned to other things as he was wont, because he was an eclectic journalist. I have other things. I'll probably move them into the presentation I make a little later. I'd really like to take some questions and hear from you about what interests you about him, and maybe what I skipped over that I need to fill in the next couple minutes. You're going to have to come up to, is there a mic there? Yeah, so I can hear you. Okay, mic and loud voice is good for me.
My apologies. Did you cover his 1915
the Winston Company published them, the Jimmy Kirkland series. The third book is called Jimmy Kirkland and the Plot for a Pennant, and it is a blueprint for anything that followed and likely anything that preceded gambling's impact on baseball and the World Series. He did not like Frank Chance very much, didn't like McGraw very much either.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Other questions, please? Anything? Yes, please.
I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about how Fullerton's reputation was attacked. Was he like driven out of baseball, or?
Baseball Magazine in 1920, baseball was the, or at least a.
Use the mic, please.
Thanks, Jacob. Baseball Magazine was, if not the, certainly a major baseball publication, and they took him to task in very rough fortune, rough fashion, for what he had wrote. Now, Huey had attacked owners all through his career up to that point, beginning in a column he wrote in 1907 called His Baseball Honor. And in that column, he said, players can't throw baseball games. People will know. Fans will know. Sports writers will know. You can't get away with it. Well, in 1919, they, in fact, didn't get away with it, because he and Christy Mathewson knew. They could tell. Other people could tell. So if you kind of look at the Kirkland book and this business, it's he didn't feel you could throw games, but he did feel that the owners could screw things up. And pretty royally, he felt that they made trades that strengthened teams in larger markets, that was encouraged by the leadership of baseball because of the commercialization and the business of baseball. And he railed against that, starting as I have found, and perhaps earlier, in 1907. So And I just, you know, the other meeting doesn't start till 5:30. I have some documents that demonstrate this. If anyone has some time and they want to see them and for themselves, I'm happy to share them with you. Any other questions? Bruce, got anything for me?
1912 World Series, there was a lot of suspicion that the Boston could lose some games.
Hey, I'm just having a little trouble here.
Did Fullerton ever write about the 1912 World Series where there were accusations that the Boston Red Sox threw some games, or at least were involved in gamblers?
That's interesting in terms of timing, because after working for the Chicago Record, which was to become the Examiner, the Herald rather, and then the Examiner, he moved in 1912 to take over the In the Wake of the News column in the Chicago Tribune. So this was his second stint of three at the Chicago Tribune. And the nature of the In the Wake column was he might have hinted around at it. That was all he was writing. No, that may not be true. He may have written other things. I mean, I can't see him just writing his silly little column in poetry every day. But I haven't seen anything overt. There may be hints. I don't understand all the poetry. I'm not very good with poetry to begin with, and especially this baseball poetry. But it's just not something, I think, for the year that he wrote the In the Wake of the column, he addressed directly. So in the June of 1913, he took the column from Hugh Keogh, who died in June of 1912, and in June of 1913, he handed the column over to Ring Lardner, who was his protege. He got Ring Lardner his first job in Chicago, and he went into a period of freelancing and syndication, wrote a lot of magazine articles, and showed up in something called the Chicago Daybook. Who's heard of the Chicago Daybook? A couple people I've talked to. The Chicago Daybook was a tabloid that existed for 2 years. It was ad-free, so it didn't make it. It depended on circulation. And I saw him in it a lot. My guess is that he didn't work for the Chicago Daybook, that they bought the Wheeler syndicate, which eventually became Bell. Yes, sir. I'm not hearing you.
Was there any talk about the 1918 World Series being fixed by Hugh Fullerton? The 1918 World Series. I thought I heard rumors that that was fixed.
Sorry. He was with the Chicago Herald and Examiner. By then, I have not been able to look at the Herald and Examiner to see if he wrote anything directly. I have not seen anything in his syndicated writings. It's worth saying, though, that no sports writer before 1919 was syndicated more than Hugh Fullerton. I found him all across the country. He was the best-known sports writer in the land for a long period of time. So I to my knowledge, no.
Excuse me. I think we need to clear the room for the dead ball.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.